to hear oral arguments from petitioner in Carolyn Greathouse versus Charter National Bank Southwest.
May it please the court. My name is Gary McConnell. I'm an attorney in Angleton, Texas. I represent the petitioner, Carolyn Greathouse, independent executrix of the estate of Clyde R. Greathouse, deceased. The facts of this case are virtually undisputed. The decedent signed a note on behalf of Forrest Allen Associates, an insurance agency, and a guarantee agreement. The assets of the agency were pledged to secure that note payable to the respondent in this case. Upon default, the bank took possession of these assets, sold them at a private sale, and credited the proceeds to the indebtedness and sued for a deficiency. The Court of Appeals' reasoning and arriving at an affirmation of the trial court's judgment in favor of the bank presents some problems in analysis. The number one problem is that the cases that they cite in reliance upon their decision to separate the burden of pleading from the burden of proof in the area of commercial reasonableness do not in fact support their position. They first say that their holding is in conformity with the SunJet Inc. versus Ford Motor Credit decision out of Dallas, because they say the language in that decision gave an inference that the debtor had asserted the lack of commercial reason. Well, what that ignores is that SunJet was a summary judgment case. Of course, the debtor could assert that in a response to the motion for summary judgment, but not necessarily plead it as an answer.
It isn't the fact here, just cutting through it all, that there have been Court of Appeals cases that go both ways in Texas. Court has never clearly spoken on it, and that it's really a policy call that we should consider what is the best for the expedition of justice, to who this burden should rest on and when it should be.
I think you're absolutely right, except I would submit to the court that I don't believe Tannenbaum versus Economics Laboratory is that unclear on this point, and I'm going to address that further on in my argument. At last count, just to respond further to the comment, at last count, at the time that this application was filed, there were at least 16 courts of appeals decisions since Tannenbaum was handed down. 14 of those decisions held that the creditor had the burden of proof, and several of those cases also asserted that the creditor had the burden to plead and prove lack of commercial reasons. Now, only two of those cases, one of which the Court of Appeals in this case relied upon heavily for its conclusion or its opinion, held to the contrary. That was Stray Inc. versus C First Commercial Corporation, and the other case, I believe, was a case out of either San Antonio or El Paso, which basically said that the lack of commercial reasonableness was an affirmative defense to be raised by the debtor. Now, Stray gives me problems, because number one, everything in that opinion about commercial reasonableness is dicta, because the Court of Appeals had no need to even address commercial reasonableness in that opinion, because the defendant's pleadings in that case had been struck as a discovery sanction, had been stricken. As a result, all of the elements or the facts and allegations in support of the plaintiff's cause of action were deemed admitted, including, if you will, the essential element that the creditor had sold the collateral with commercial reasons. So to come along after making that finding and write about commercial reasonableness was not essential to the outcome of that case. And this Court of Appeals' reliance upon Stray is simply not justified because of that. Now, I had, in preparation for this argument, done some research that led me to believe that Section 1.102B of the Texas Business and Commerce Code, which is, as you know, is the Texas codification of the UCC, mandated, or didn't mandate, it sought as a laudatory goal that this state, along with other states, should try to make uniform the laws of the various jurisdictions concerning the application of the statutes contained therein. In doing that, I decided to do some review on a national basis of how other states feel about this area of commercial reasons. I have prepared and filed this morning a supplemental brief, and I apologize for the lateness of that filing. It simply took me a lot more time than what I had planned. Essentially, 44 states have addressed the area of the burden of proof of commercial reasons. 43 of those states have clearly and unequivocally placed that burden upon the creditor. Only one state, the state of Alabama, has definitively placed that burden upon the debtor as an affirmative defense. Now, the burden of proof, obviously, based upon that review, and this incidentally is supported by other commentators, and I've referred to them in my supplemental brief, including Anderson on his work on Uniform Commercial Code. The next step, of course, in the analysis is if you do not assume that the burden of pleading goes along with the burden of proof, which I think takes a fairly great step to make that conclusion, then in looking at the cases nationwide that have considered whether or not the burden of pleading and the burden of proof are both on the creditor, you will not find many cases that have specifically addressed that. I only found about 8 or 9 cases.
Do you find in the cases a distinction between deficiency actions, suits for deficiency, as opposed to suits to set aside the foreclosure?
If by suits to set aside the foreclosure you're indicating a suit brought by the debtor, which I assume you are, yes, there is a distinction made in most jurisdictions, which would be in accordance with, I think, the Texas feeling on pleading. That is, the debtor trying to set aside a foreclosure, or in, I think under the UCC, what they attempt to do is to seek damages or an injunction as another remedy. They clearly place the burden of proof under those circumstances on the debtor. That is, of course, the in accord with the normal pleading practice in this state, that the person seeking relief has the burden of proof.
So your research would indicate that if the suit is brought by the debtor should have the burden. If the suit is brought by the creditor should have the burden.
In those states that have specifically addressed that, that is correct. I think that's mostly uniform, except perhaps with the state of Alabama. Now, of the 7, 8, or 9 cases, I don't recall the number, that have specifically addressed the pleading aspects of commercial reasonableness, it is about 7-2 in favor of the burden being placed directly upon the creditor to plead it, as well as proof. And I think that a fair reading of the other cases, of the other states that have addressed the issue of the burden of proof, you will see strong language in those cases that seem to indicate that they would likewise place that burden of pleading upon the creditor had that particular issue been presented. So I believe in order to reach the goal promulgated by the legislature in adopting the Texas version of the Uniform Commercial Code of making uniform decisions concerning commercial transactions throughout the land, that this court, in order to be among the vast majority of jurisdictions that have considered this point, clearly and in accordance with Tannenbaum, should and would hold that the burden of proof as to commercial reasonableness should lie upon the debtor, excuse me, the creditor. So the real question or questions are twofold. Number one, the question of the burden of pleading, which I've just touched upon a moment ago, and two, the appropriate remedy for the failure of the creditor to dispose of the collateral in a, quote, commercially reasonable manner, as dictated by Section 9.504 of the Texas Business and Commerce Code. Across the country, this has been boiled down to three different remedies. Now, I think Texas has already addressed this in the Tannenbaum versus Economics Laboratory case that I'll touch upon in a moment. But these three remedies consist of basically a choice among, one, the absolute bar rule, which is essentially if the creditor does not comply, strictly comply with Section 9.504, his right to recover a deficiency against the debtor is barred. Two, the rebuttable presumption rule. And this is where Tannenbaum has already addressed this particular aspect in Texas. The rebuttable presumption rule simply is that even if the creditor doesn't comply with the requirements that the disposition of the collateral be commercially reasonable, he may still recover judgment for deficiency against the debtor if he overcomes a rebuttable presumption that the value of the collateral equal the debt at the time of the sale. What this fails to do is accord the protections that are necessary to a debtor that are inherent in the absolute borrower, i.e., to require compliance by the creditor with the rule set forth in Section 9.504 of commercial reasons. That all aspects.
Why doesn't this, in this case, controlled by Rule 54 regarding conditions precedent? I mean, why should parties litigate an issue be forced to plead and prove an issue, or I should say prove an issue, which is really not a genuine issue of disputed fact between them?
I was afraid of that question because I didn't understand that this court had granted writ on that particular point, but I will address it. I believe that sometimes conditions preceding are used sort of loosely, and I saw some of this in some of the other courts' opinions in this area, to indicate really a burden of proof. But if we're talking about Rule 54 in Texas civil procedure that deals with these particular aspects there, I don't think that's applicable where you have case law that is already established, I think, clearly, that the burden of proof and that an essential element of the creditor's right to recover is proof of commercial reasons. Because I don't know of a single place in our common law, not statutorily, because there are some statutorily enacted conditions preceding, I don't know of a single case where a condition preceding has been allowed to substitute for a plaintiff's burden of proof. Conditions preceding, I think, are generally those that are commonly found in contracts which may require that something be done in advance of a right to recover, such as an insurance policy, filing a claim within a certain period of time, or doing some act as a predicate to have a right to recover against the insurance company. I think that that is a separate area that does not go to the true issue as to whether or not the area or the issue of commercial reasonableness should be included in the burden of proof and the burden of pleading of the creditor.
So the creditor will be forced to call witnesses to prove commercial reasonableness even when that is truly not a disputed fact issue between the parties, just to satisfy the proof of the essential element you claim in their cause of action.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would submit that would be consistent with any other case where a plaintiff is seeking relief, that plaintiff is presumed to know all of the essential elements of recovery, and that plaintiff, unless there's some other procedural thing that allows that plaintiff to get by with that, such as deemed admissions, must adduce and present evidence on every fact in support of its essential elements of recovery. And that's all that we're involved with here. Now, I think if this court were to treat the plea, as the Court of Appeals did in this case, the commercial unreasonableness as being a condition preceding, what it's doing is it's taking a step back from the requirement of national uniformity or the goal of national uniformity in applying the law to commercial transactions across the country.
What's your third remedy that you were going to list?
I'm sorry, the third remedy is offset. Only two states, one of which was Alabama and the other was Arizona, allow as the sole remedy for a debtor the right of offset against the creditor's claim deficiency by pleading and proving damages that debtor has suffered as a result of the creditor's failure to comply with the requirements of commercial reasons. Obviously, by virtue of the fact there's only two states that have adopted that has not been an acceptable remedy in the vast majority of the states.
And you think clear. Tannenbaum sets up the rebuttable presumption rule?
I think Tannenbaum disposed of the rebuttable presumption rule. I think Tannenbaum, because of its very language, and I will direct the court to specifically page 771 of the opinion, because in Tannenbaum the court was reviewing a lower court opinion as well as a prior opinion, the Royal Ex Inc. versus E.F. Johnson Company, in which those two courts had exactly handed down their findings based upon the rebuttable presumption. And in 771, it said basically we hold that the Court of Civil Appeals in Royal Ex and again in Tannenbaum has misinterpreted Chapter 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. And I believe that that was basically taking the position that Texas would not adopt the rebuttable presumption rule. My time is out. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, I submit that the only issue before this court is which party has the initial burden of alleging or pleading lack of notice or notice, commercial reasonableness or lack of commercial reasonableness in connection with the disposition of collateral when there is a deficiency sought. Stated another way, is the burden on the lender or the conditional seller, or on the other hand, is the burden upon the borrower or the conditional purchaser? The issue is not which party has the ultimate burden of proof. That was not the basis.
Who do you say has the burden of proof? You agree that the creditor has the burden of proof?
That is a, I don't know that that is an issue that we have to address, but I think I would concede that the creditor has the burden of proof once and if the debtor has initially met his burden of pleading. And Charter does not seek to extend the Court of Appeals opinion beyond its limited ruling. Contrary to opposing counsel, I do not believe that this court has squarely addressed this issue in Tannenbaum or otherwise. If it had, I think that the subsequent courts of appeal would have cited and disposed of the proceedings because of Tannenbaum. The Texas Business and Commerce Code likewise does not give us any specific direction with regard to the pleading element. As Judge Phillips has indicated, it appears to me that there have been a number of courts of appeals opinions and that there is a split of opinion. And I do not believe, quite frankly, that those opinions can be reconciled. So as is frequently the case, this court is called upon to decide not what is the law, but what should be the law, what would be the appropriate policy. It is Charter's position that...
You're saying it's an affirmative defense that must be raised.
I don't know that I would call it an affirmative defense, but to me it doesn't matter, it's not important whether you call it an affirmative defense or not, but I do in fact say that the initial burden of putting an issue is that of the borrower or conditional purchaser. So if an affirmative defense is a defense that must be raised by the defendant, yes, Your Honor, I would take that position. Now, once the defendant has so pled and put the plaintiff or the financial institution on notice, then for the purpose of this case, I would concede that the creditor has the burden of proof. I would suggest to the court that the practical considerations indicate that this position is appropriate, and I think that it is also fair.
Could you not also argue that whose responsibility it is not only to prove but to raise it depends upon the remedy being sought? For instance, if the creditor, as in this case, has not only foreclosed but is seeking a deficiency judgment, would that not be a philosophical reason for saying that since they are seeking a deficiency judgment, the burden should be on the creditor to both to prove that it was commercially reasonable?
To prove or to allege, Your Honor?
To allege and prove.
I would suggest in both instances the burden is upon the alleged debtor to plead. Now, I find that it is inconsistent, that opposing counsel's position is inconsistent in saying that were there a suit brought initially by the borrower challenging the foreclosure or public sale, that the burden would be upon him. I think that that is an inconsistent position. My position is that in either case, the burden of pleading should be upon the borrower or conditional purchaser.
Thank you.
recognizing that much has been written on this area, and we have both public sales and private sales, and here we had a private sale, and recognizing that there are five different things that can happen to a creditor if he violates the law of commercial reasonableness, including such things as criminal liability, tort liability, statutory liability under 9507, denial of a deficiency judgment. And there are all sorts of things if a creditor violates this particular rule. Since the creditor is going after the debtor for the deficiency, why should not the creditor have to prove it?
These are the practical considerations that I would like to address. Contrary to what has been stated in one or more opinion, I suggest that the borrower has equal or greater access to the facts. Certainly, the borrower will be able to know whether he received notice of a public or private sale and can allege one way or the other. Also, you have in many of these situations a lender which has no particular expertise with regard to the collateral and may well have less expertise. A situation not unusual is a situation where you have a VP of a bank, an assistant vice president, loaning money on some collateral that he has no particular expertise. Whereas on the other hand, the borrower may be the distributor, seller, or the daily user of that collateral. So while the lender admittedly may have greater access to what he did with that collateral, the borrower in many instances may have greater knowledge with regard to what is the fair market value of that collateral or how that fair market value can best be achieved. So I would say at the very least, the debtor has equal access to the facts.
Counsel, haven't most of the cases using your illustrations gone against you? If you foreclose on an airplane, you must use the standard methods in foreclosing that are used to sell an airplane. You can't just put it in the Sunday supplement.
I will agree that if we would total up the cases that have been cited by both parties in this case, the greater number of cases have ruled against me.
Is that true nationwide as well? Do you agree with that survey?
I do not disagree with the survey. I have not made my own independent
survey. How strong is our obligation to try to achieve a uniform national commercial law?
My cursory review of the survey and the supplemental brief, which I just received today, is that there is a lack of uniformity. And regardless of how this court rules, that lack of uniformity will remain.
Counsel, are you familiar with the authors Summers and White, who have published they publish both a textbook used in law schools and they also publish hornbooks on the Uniform Commercial Code?
I am familiar with the authors, yes, sir.
Under section 27-16, they advance this philosophy. The burden of proof as to commercial reasonableness should be on the party responsible for and in control of the very procedures called into question, especially given that it is that party, the secured party, who benefits from an affirmative showing of commercial reasonableness. That's the position, that they are in control of the very procedures that are being exercised, so therefore it should be their burden.
Well, once again, I am not addressing the burden issue. And secondly, there is the words in there called into issue, and that's what I'm asking the borrower to do, is to call it into issue. Now, sales of personal property differ from sales of real estate. Sales of foreclosure sales of real estate are circumscribed by some fairly detailed statutes. The deeds of trust that are commonly used are rather specific in the procedures that the secured lender should take. On the other hand, there is little guidance in the Texas Business and Commerce Code as to what is an appropriate procedure for the sale of personal property. And there is seldom very much specificity in the commonly used security agreements. So we have a situation here where, unlike in real estate, we have no single definition as to commercial reasonableness. I have seen and read in some of these cases some very elaborate steps that were taken to sell collateral. There was one with regard to helicopters. And to me, that was an exhaustive attempt to sell it, but yet there was a finding that that was not commercially reasonable. So there is little guidance to a foreclosing lender of personal property as to what is commercial reasonableness. Each sale will have to stand on its own particular facts. The sale of a helicopter, the sale of specialized construction equipment, the sale of stock that's not commonly traded, the sale of home mortgages as a package, each one of those are different animals. So the lender really has very little guidelines. So I think that those differences militate that the borrower has the initial burden to tell the lender, does he have a complaint, and if so, what it is.
Now let's what is the practical difference in assigning the burden of pleading? Isn't it true that it won't be much of a burden on either side?
Well, I think the practical thing is that if there is no issue, in my mind, the bank should be able to proceed with a motion for summary judgment or proceed with trial without having to proceed with discovery and those attendant delays.
But given our liberal pleading rules, you will never know that.
Well,
I mean, we require you to...
That's true,
to
but
get
at least...
case ready before you know what the issues are, the way our rules are structured.
What I suggest is that these issues, or many of these issues, require expert witnesses. And
but
that
I mean, isn't any prudent lender going to try to resolve this well prior to trial by admissions or interrogatories, rather than by the absence of a pleading, which can be totally freely amended within 7 days of trial and pretty freely amended less than 7 days from trial?
One, the pleadings do at least put the lender on notice that he has to start thinking about experts. But what we have in the absence of pleadings is that the lender must speculate. Does he need an expert? How many experts does he need? On what issues does he need the experts? But let's talk about...
But you're going to have the same speculation even if there's just a general denial.
Well, at least there is less speculation. You know, the retort is, why don't you proceed with discovery? Well, my first rhetorical question is, why do we have to go through that delay and expense if there is no one has raised an issue? But passing that rhetorical issue, my experience has been that unless you have some pleadings to kind of frame the issues, discovery really goes nowhere. That is, assuming there is a general denial, how do I proceed with discovery? A typical way would be I submit an interrogatory saying, do you have any objections to the sale of the collateral or the lack of notice? Typically, what I get is my attorney is investigating that objection, legal question, or we have not yet designated experts. So unless, and I don't think that the creditor should have to go through that evasive type of action or deal with that until the debtor has at least said, I've got a complaint. So I don't think it's unfair that the debtor would simply say, we allege that there was insufficient notice, or we challenge the commercial reasonableness. Now, I would
so you could file a motion for summary judgment, but that could be blocked by an amended pleading and an answer that challenges commercial reasonableness.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, what was the collateral?
The collateral was something called insurance commissions or renewals or expirations. The maker of the note was an insurance agency, and the guarantor was a principal in that agency. I'd like to deal with, I didn't know whether...
Was there a question on valuation of the insurance renewal commissions?
The record is silent on that. The record simply indicates that there was a sale of it, but there was no pleadings, no evidence, no cross-examination as to whether the value obtained was or was not reasonable.
Was it sold to a third party?
The record does not reflect that. In fact, contrary to what opposing counsel said, I don't think the record reflected whether it was a public or a private sale. I may be wrong on that. I'd like to comment on something that earlier question, I believe, by Judge Cornyn, and that is one of the things that the bank was relying on in the trial court was that it did indeed allege pursuant to Rule 54 that all conditions preceding had been met, and that should have put the defendant on notice that he had to allege something with regard to any deficiencies in the notice and the sale.
Do you contend that Rule 94 has any applicability here? Any brief cite?
94, as I recall, lists the affirmative defenses.
Well, it lists a whole bunch of them, and then it says something like, in any other matter constituting an avoidance or affirmative defense.
Well, obviously, in this particular case, there is no specific reference in Rule 94 to this. I would say that that the court, in effect, is going to have to be making a policy decision as to whether this is one of those affirmative defenses. And not all affirmative defenses are specifically alleged in Rule 94. Now, in Rule 93, which is the verified defenses, there are duties imposed upon a defendant to allege whether he claims that there was lack of notice and presentment of a claim. There is a burden with regard to pleading exceptions under an insurance policy. So, in some contexts, there is no the defendant is required to allege lack of notice and certain exclusions. I see that my time is up. Are there any
questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the second clause. The court will take another brief recess.
My name is Lee Bryce.